Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by Independence Blue Cross.
I'm Mike and Scott. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. And this week, another mass shooting, more violence, this time in San Bernardino, California. 14 people were killed. I'm sure you were following the news. I'm sure you've read the first slew of opinion pieces. Perhaps you've gotten into arguments over how many mass shootings have happened in this country in this year. So we were asking ourselves, what are some of the issues that we're not talking about, but maybe we should. Two things came to mind. One is that many people are advocating that we treat violence as a public health issue. But what exactly does that look like? And secondly, why is it so hard or really impossible to talk about this issue? We're almost looking at each other as enemies and not as a group of people trying to figure something out. Let's start with the public health issue. Gary Slutkin is an epidemiologist. He spent years fighting the AIDS epidemic in Africa, and then he took many of the lessons learned there to his new endeavor, an organization called Cure Violence. One of their most basic beliefs is that violence spreads like a contagious disease and can be addressed with some of the same methods. I asked him to explain that.
Well, it means really that we've missed the bigger picture and the detail. The bigger picture is that this is primarily a health problem, that the people who are doing it have acquired a social or psychological disease, and the health sector knows very well how to look for rare events and how to prevent the spread of rare events. This is a subspecialty within public health that's called disease or epidemic control, and it uses outreach workers, and that's what we use in Cure Violence on streets. We've done this in 25 cities and 60 communities on four continents. We have interrupters and outreach workers, and when used, violence drops dramatically. You have to find the right people, train them, and organize this well.
If we're looking at gun violence, does it matter what kind of gun violence it is? We often spend a lot of time after a shooting analyzing, was it politically motivated? Was it a workplace dispute? Was it a terrorist shooting? So does that matter?
God, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I'm watching the news myself and watching people searching for the reasons. And I don't know what the reason is that people want to find the reasons, but the reasons change all the time. I mean, what's relevant is that people are doing what they're believing that they're going to get some kind of approval in some space for, whether it's from friends or colleagues or from the internet space.
I can picture how the interrupter model works if we're talking perhaps about gang violence that is confined to an area. How could this interrupter model work for more seemingly random shootings?
Well, it isn't. Nothing's random, and they may appear to be. For example, school shootings, there are ways in which outreach can be designed where people can check out, you know, what's going on in dorms, what's going on in classes, and finding out, you know, who is feeling relatively socially isolated, or, you know, no, they haven't heard from him, or they're worried about this person. You end up helping a lot of people, not just who are, you know, thinking about doing something today or tomorrow or the next day, but people who are highly susceptible and might be thinking about an event that might occur, you know, weeks or months in the future.
Your approach focuses more on behavior than guns themselves, right?
It's a recognition that there are hundreds of millions of guns out there. You know, in terms of feasibility of interacting with this problem right now, we're getting reductions of, you know, up to 70%, frequently 40, 50%. There's three neighborhoods in Baltimore that have gone over a year, one a year and a half without a shooting or a killing. A neighborhood in New York that's gone nearly 3 years.
And how many interrupters do you have on the ground in, let's say, a Baltimore neighborhood that has gone without a shooting?
Well, you'd be surprised to know that it's only about eight.
How big is the neighborhood?
Well, this is a neighborhood of like 40 or 60,000 people. You know, this all gets mapped out. This, again, this is a specialty within public health called epidemic control. I mean, some of the greatest achievements in humankind have been as a result of public health. I mean, whether it's eradication of smallpox or almost elimination of polio, leprosy, TB, giant accomplishments. So I just think that the framing of this issue, people are still in the wrong. They're not up on the current theory of violence as a contagious health issue.
Gary, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Gary Slutkin is an epidemiologist. He heads an organization called Cure Violence that takes a public health approach to treating violence. And whether you agree with him or not, think for a moment of the person in your life who most opposes your views on guns and violence. Now imagine you're sitting down with that person and you're talking about what Gary just said. Would it be possible to have a relatively calm conversation about his ideas? Probably not, right? Sheila Heen has co-authored a book called Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. She's a lecturer at Harvard Law School, and she says we come to these conversations with firm beliefs and we end up just talking past each other. So I asked her if that can be avoided.
Well, I think that part of what would help is actually to start with agreement, because I would guess that there isn't anyone in the country who would say, we don't have a problem. We have a problem with mass shootings. What we disagree about is actually what would help in terms of what to do about it. I think actually stepping back to give some leeway to, look, this is an incredibly complex problem. There are a lot of contributing factors. And if we in the United States are going to be able to do something about this, we probably are all right, meaning we are all correct that there are a number of factors that need to be addressed and improved in order to actually change the dynamic.
When you are having a difficult conversation, how do you deal with feeling offended when the other person says something that seems to strike at your core or your core beliefs?
Yeah, I think that trying not to feel offended is probably not going to work, because you're going to have emotional reactions in the conversation. The challenge is, can you recognize the emotional reactions that you're having? Can you name them rather than letting them actually fuel a counterattack or an accusation? So just saying, look, I find that really upsetting, or it sounds like you're not very sympathetic. If you can just name that calmly, then you can go on to add, you know, here's what I see. If you don't name it, you'll end up saying, you know, well, that's ridiculous and that's racist, or that's just shows that you don't really care about these issues. And so when we don't name or express feelings, then they turn into judgments, accusations, etc.
Given the highly political nature of this discussion, is there any hope that we can have these conversations and have them well?
You know, one of the dilemmas that we have in Washington today is that we have a lot of structures that are set up to actually deadlock the process. Given the 24/7 media coverage and given how split the country really is in terms of who we're voting for, politicians have a bigger incentive to beat their chest and block the other side because they believe that that's going to win them the swing votes that they need to get reelected. And that's going to be covered by the media. The more extreme it is, the more coverage they'll get. And that actually has a bigger payoff in their mind than actually working with the other side to get something done.
With the holidays coming up, is there any way to change the dynamic other than playing Hello by Adele? Is there any way to change the dynamic around the table when you are really disagreeing with people you love on some level and people who are your relatives, to not get into these fights and instead perhaps learn something new about them?
One of the things that I did over Thanksgiving was use the StoryCorps app, in fact, to interview each of my parents. And one of the nice things about that idea, which is that you're just curious about what's going on or the history or the views or the feelings of someone else, is that it puts you in the stance of, we don't need to agree about anything. I'm just interested in learning more. And sometimes when I'm at the dinner table, I try to put myself in that mindset. Like, we don't have to agree because we're not actually setting policy here over dinner for the United States. So we don't have to agree with each other. We just have to try to understand, why would you see that as the biggest problem? One of the things I've found useful in political discussions is the question, what worries you the most? And you'll cut through the policy arguments to get to, well, what I'm worried about is if we don't do that or do what I'm recommending, here's what will happen. Or if we do what you're recommending, here's what will get sacrificed. That question often leads to a much more interesting conversation.
Sheila, thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Sheila Hain is a lecturer at Harvard Law School. She has written Difficult Conversations, How to Talk About What Matters Most. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. On Wednesday, as law enforcement personnel scoured San Bernardino, California for the shooters, young people across that city sheltered in place in their schools. Lockdowns have become a common practice for school children across the nation. With that in mind, we wanted to listen back to a story produced by former teacher and youth radio reporter Robin Gee. She did this story in 2013, and she took us inside a lockdown drill.
I never did lockdown drills with my 8th grade students, but now lockdowns are becoming standard. Julia Gellarmino has a game she plays with her 1st graders. She calls it hide and seek. It starts with an announcement on the PA that Dr. Locke is in the building.
That's our special code, where you need to make sure your eyes are on Miss G and you're looking to her for directions.
Next, all 21 kids in their uniforms head to the bathroom. And one by one, they line up and squish inside the small room.
There is no talking. There's no talking.
On her cue,
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All her students crouch down on the floor and become silent. Well, almost all of them.
So right now, I don't want to scare you, but Lily, if somebody was trying to harm us and you were making that much sound, guess where they're going to go first? Here. So right now, you weren't helping us to be safe.
These kids are used to drills. They're used to real lockdowns, too. Gellarmino says she never knows the reasons until afterwards. It could be a robbery in the neighborhood or something more serious. Since the shooting in Newtown, the lockdowns have meant some really hard conversations with her 1st graders.
How do we stay safe when someone else is trying to harm us? And they started talking about how, you know, we kind of play our game of, like, hide and seek. And One of my kids asked what would happen if they shot through the door. And so she had obviously watched the things on the news.
It's the end of the day now, and the tension of the school day fills this teacher's classroom. On average, at least 3 schools are shut down in Oakland every week. Neighboring cities like Berkeley and San Jose also use lockdowns, sometimes even for preschoolers. Often, teachers, parents, and students are unaware of the severity of the situation. Some parents receive a text when a lockdown is in progress. Other parents get the news through a note in their kid's backpack the next day. Troy Flint of the Oakland Unified School District says parents are demanding even more security.
I've received many unsolicited emails from parents, which were also sent to the superintendent and board members, asking for increased police presence.
But how does that feel to a 6-and-a-half-year-old? I asked Gustavo Hernandez about the drills in his elementary school.
I feel kind of, like, scared.
Can you tell me why?
Because if we forgot, like, to close everything, the strangers could get us.
But Hernandez says he understands they need to practice.
You need to, like, lose your fear.
How do you lose your fear?
Like, if you want to lose your fear, you can do this.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. The news will make your head spin these days, right? It's so hard to concentrate with everything that's going on. In addition, do you have 300 unanswered emails? So many projects do. Oh, and the dry cleaning needs to be picked up, and your friend's birthday is coming up. When your brain is racing like this, wouldn't it be amazing to find something to help you get everything done on your to-do list? Some overwhelmed people are scoring stimulant drugs prescribed to treat ADHD, claiming that they help them be hyper-focused and super alert for hours. Aside from the obvious legal issues, is this a genius way to deal with all of our brain challenges? Is it cheating, downright unethical, unhealthy? Todd Bookman dove into the debate around the wider use of so-called smart drugs.
It's not really all that hard to find a college student who is or who knows someone taking Ritalin or Adderall.
Yeah, I definitely know a few people who take these drugs, who get them from friends who are prescribed, who source them from other places without being prescribed. Yeah.
Farah Rahaman is a junior majoring in global studies at Drexel University. She says students don't see much risk in taking it or sharing it with others. In fact, something like a third of undergrads have taken so-called smart drugs without a prescription. There's lots of supply and plenty of demand.
People are taking these drugs because of the excessive pressures they face to perform, to meet the demands of a rigorous curriculum, but more than that, to meet the extracurricular demands. And that's really hard. It's hard to be a student.
And it's not like it necessarily gets easier after graduation. Between jobs and family and kids' sports and work emails at all hours, a lot of people feel like they're stuck on a hamster wheel. Or, to use a less photogenic animal, the rat race.
What's not clear is how you get off the rat race.
This is Anjan Chatterjee. He's chair of the neurology department at Pennsylvania Hospital. And he believes that if people think smart drugs help them succeed, help them be more focused or productive, then they should have access to them. As simple as that.
It would be a mistake to think that I'm a proponent of people using these smart drugs as much as being a proponent of people having the choice to use smart drugs.
The same way people have the choice to use alcohol and nicotine. They're drugs that can also be abused, but adults are reasonably free to use them as they wish. It's a libertarian take on the doctor-patient relationship. Although Chatterjee doesn't think smart drugs should be available at every 7-Eleven.
For the time being, I think they need to go through physicians, and in large part to be able to educate people about what the potential risks and benefits are, and so people know when we think they're relatively safe, what the parameters of that are.
He cites research showing Ritalin and Adderall are relatively safe when taken in the correct dose, at least in the short term. The long-term effects and the addictive qualities are less understood, something Chatterjee would like to see more research done on. And that shortage of concrete evidence about their safety makes this question of access to smart drugs controversial. Then there's the fact that even the benefits aren't exactly clear. Amy Arnston is a professor of neuroscience at Yale Medical School. She says the desire for a chemical boost is an understandable reaction to the demands of today's economy.
We are in the information age, where to succeed, to thrive, you need the full functioning of a part of your brain called the prefrontal cortex, which is what my lab studies.
The prefrontal cortex is the part of your brain located just behind the forehead.
Our work has shown that prefrontal cortex is like Goldilocks, has to have everything just right.
But fatigue and even small amounts of stress impair the prefrontal cortex and limit our ability to compete and succeed. Arnston says stimulants like Ritalin and Adderall don't turn us into geniuses. They work by correcting the neurochemical environment so our brains are in an optimal state.
You can't produce a supernormal brain with these drugs. You simply are trying to make up for fatigue or stress.
But the thing is, research shows that for healthy adults, that is, people without ADHD, Adderall has little impact on performance. People don't score better on tests or have sharper memories. Instead, these pills seem to have more to do with motivation and drive. They make monotonous or unpleasant tasks more tolerable, kind of the same way coffee does.
Caffeine is also a quote-unquote smart drug. It can help us, especially when we're fatigued. I know in my own case, has a huge effects on my cognitive abilities. But none of us think of that as something that's unethical because we have an inherent understanding that this is not making us supermen. This is simply allowing us to get a little closer to our best selves.
But what if our best self loses out on the promotion to the dude a cubicle over taking Ritalin? Is that ethical? If we create a world where anybody who wants to can take smart drugs, do those of us who don't take it end up at a disadvantage? Do we even want to live in that world where everyone's hamster wheel is spinning faster and faster? Maybe the smartest drug of all will be the one that gets us off the wheel. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and now we're going to take a look at the use of performance-enhancing drugs in a more menacing environment, the battlefield. Stimulant drugs have become part of the story of the rise and terror of ISIS in Syria.
Captagon, an amphetamine that was banned in 1986 due to its highly addictive nature, is now a favorite of ISIS and Syrian fighters.
A captured ISIS militant named Kareem tells CNN how he got his battlefield courage.
They gave us drugs, hallucinogenic pills that would make you go to battle not caring if you live or die.
They use a cocktail of hash, cough syrup, and now
Captagon.
Captagon.
Captagon, a drug that is fueling the Syrian civil conflict.
Captagon, which is one of the brand names for phenethylamine, was an early ADHD drug in the 1970s until it became illegal in most countries in the 1980s. Of course, this isn't the first time soldiers have abused drugs. There is a long history of that.
If we begin with looking at particularly with the U.S. Civil War, morphine was the most widely used and abused drug, as well as alcohol. The soldiers were actually paid in alcohol when there weren't monies to pay them.
That's Dessa Bergen-Seco. She has written War and Drugs, the Role of Military Conflict in the Development of Substance Abuse.
If we look at World War II, amphetamines were used during the Cold War. We had a huge increase in escalation and use of LSD. If we look at the Vietnam War, the use of heroin and cannabis or marijuana were most pronounced among military, the veterans. And then through the Afghan wars, heroin was made readily available to the Russian soldiers. And then with the Operation Enduring Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom, the hallmark substance of abuse is also opioids, the synthetic opiates. And now we're seeing here with ISIS or Daesh the use of the Captagon stimulants.
Dessa, tell me more about the use of amphetamines during World War II.
Yes, both sides used amphetamines pretty extensively during World War II, and they used them to keep energy up, focus, foster aggression. That was called Pilipan when it was used by the Japanese prior to their kamikaze missions. Pervitin was the trade name for the type of amphetamine that the Nazis were using, and there was a whole host of market names of amphetamines that were used by the U.S. and other allied forces.
How were these drugs distributed to soldiers during World War II?
During World War II, they were produced in terms of, if you're looking at pharmaceutical-grade production, and very systematically distributed from the military command on all sides to the soldiers on the front lines.
Did they snort them, inject them? How were they ingested?
They came in pill form for the most part. They were just taken as a fighting aid and a sort of a supplement. It's estimated that they distributed about 200 million amphetamine pills to U.S. soldiers during World War II. And there were massive stockpiles of amphetamines after the war, and they were dumped in the market in Japan. And Japan struggled certainly with, they had significant social trauma following the bombings there. And then you had this flooding of amphetamines in the market. And they struggled really for decades with addiction and abuse issues with that.
Now, are amphetamines best suited as a drug in warfare? I mean, we've seen other wars where people used a lot of marijuana. That seems perhaps more like a sedative. So talk about some different drugs and how they played roles.
Well, as with any time that you're using drugs, if you're looking at their role in warfare, the type of substance you're using matches with what is the mind state that you're trying to achieve. And so there's this lethal synergy between military confrontation and the consumption of mind-altering substances. And if we're looking at the use of marijuana, heroin, things like that, you're looking at people trying to deal with, generally with anxiety, emotional pain, and to disassociate from the sort of moral injury that they've been involved in, the, you know, witnessing man's inhumanity to man. Whereas on the other hand, if you're looking at sometimes the use of moderate amounts of alcohol and stimulants like amphetamine, those are intentionally used before battle in terms of preparation to sort of get people riled up. But as a performance enhancement or a psychotic or emotional aid, what's going on now with Daesh is the most clear-cut example of chemical-fueled rage to go above and beyond what humanity is prepared to do.
Dessa Bergen-Seco is a professor of public health at Syracuse University and the author of War and Drugs, The Role of Military Conflict in the Development of Substance Abuse. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. With so much gun violence in the news, non-lethal violence might seem like a less important topic. But when you're getting kicked, punched, or spit on in your workplace, it's something that needs to be talked about. This is a reality for many healthcare workers. A 2014 survey of close to 800 nurses found that half of them had been physically assaulted by patients within the last year. Lori Grover is a nurse at a locked psychiatric facility in Worcester, Massachusetts, and the patient population at her hospital has grown to include not just chronically mentally ill patients, but people facing criminal charges. Here's her story.
I see a great deal of patients pretending to be psychotic to get out of jail. They just think, oh, crazy people hit people, so I'm going to hit people so they'll think I'm crazy. We just had a couple of patients who were just acting up. They were kind of taunting us with the with these metal objects. So I grabbed the guy's arm so he couldn't stab me, and the other mental health worker grabbed the other side, and we're trying to get him to drop it. You know, I was pulled up from the ground by my hair while one of them was punching me in the face. I'm 51 years old, and I was in the Army for 21 years. You know, I've got a few extra pounds on me, so I'm not at my fighting weight anymore. I will just say he was a young, athletic male. It shouldn't hurt to be a nurse. I've been doing this for 32 years. I've had both of my thumbs broken. I've been bit. I've been spit on. I've been hurt a lot of different ways, but this was just the worst beating I've ever taken in my life. I was out from May 5th until July 23rd. I still have bulging discs in my back. I still have flashbacks. You know, I'll be walking in Walmart looking for toothbrushes and all of a sudden see a fist coming at my face. There are things that the hospitals can do to provide safe environment for the patients and the staff. I have no doubt in my mind that if we had one or two extra people on the unit that night, that I would not have been out of work for, 2.5 months.
Psychiatric nurse Lori Grover talking about workplace violence that she experienced. Reporter Tanya English looked into this issue for The Pulse, and she spoke with health researchers who are trying to better understand the scope of the problem.
60% of the on-the-job assaults that force people to miss work happen in healthcare. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which surveys workers and counts up incidents across the United States. Lisa Wolf is an emergency room nurse in Northampton, Massachusetts. To take someone's blood pressure or to listen to a person's lungs, sometimes she has to get within swinging range of a combative patient.
The guy kicked across the bed and kicked me right in the head. I really kind of had my bells rung a little bit, and I sat down for a second, and people are like, are you all right? Can you, do you need to go home? I'm like, no, I've got this sick baby in the next room. And I just got up and went back to work.
Wolf cares for patients, and she also leads research at the Emergency Nurses Association. When her team surveyed 13,000 nurses, about 12% reported they dealt with physical violence within the last week. Wolf says patient attacks can be predictable, but nurses need skills to size up a scene. Noise, poor lighting, not enough security, and long wait times are all ingredients that can contribute to violence against health workers. Many nurses don't bother to report to management or press charges.
Nurses were actually told, this is an emergency room. What do you expect? This is part of your job. We don't want to make a fuss. I think the feeling that a lot of nurses have is that nothing's going to change. Why should I stay after my shift to fill out this paper that's going to end up in a void?
And there's another consideration.
If you have an elderly dementia patient that's frightened and scared and flailing, you know, do you really want to call in law enforcement?
Paula Bizzard is an executive with Pennsylvania's Hospital Association. She says most medical centers have a safety plan that includes strategies to protect employees. She says the number one factor in preventing workplace violence is hospital leaders who make safety a priority. But nurses' unions say for them, the number one fix is more staffing. Bizzard disagrees.
I don't think numbers are necessarily going to make that difference as much as having the right staff and having the staff trained and having the right policies in place.
In Philadelphia, Drexel University is studying paramedics who've been assaulted. The health researchers asked the medics, what would make you feel safer?
They said, you can give us guns, body armor, and mace. And that, to me, is a response that is based on a very stressful work environment.
That's injury researcher Jennifer Taylor. She says when you're a first responder and you're called to someone's home to help, and you become the victim, that changes how you do your job.
And I totally understand when people have said it took everything in my power not to strike back, pick up an oxygen bottle and throw it at them, say something disrespectful.
Psychiatry, pediatrics, and the emergency department are among the settings where health workers are most vulnerable. And the government seems to be taking more notice. In recent years, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, has issued citations and threatened to fine a handful of hospitals that don't have an adequate plan to protect workers. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Aggressive behavior is one of the issues associated with dementia and Alzheimer's, of course not in all patients, but care facilities often struggle to find activities and therapies that keep their clients calm and bring joy to their lives. Now, a program in Colorado is trying something different. A local conservation group, the Bird Conservancy of the Rockies, is bringing nature into the nursing home. Stephanie Page Ogburn reports.
Inside a small and plainly decorated room at North Glen Heights Memory Care Facility on the outskirts of Denver, Colorado, volunteer Dale Jones is walking slowly around a circle of older adults.
This is a morning dove. I'll let you hold on to that this morning.
Jones is giving out colorful plush birds that fit neatly in their hands. These are essentially small stuffed animals shaped like blue jays or robins.
Yeah, you can just hold on to it, and if you want to listen to it sing, press right here in the middle.
Right through the middle.
Yeah, there's a little, you know, there you go.
Just push it and squeak on you.
Each toy bird makes chirps that match their species. Soon the room sounds almost like a forest.
Squeaks. I've never seen that before.
It may seem a little strange, but these plush birds are part of a therapeutic educational program for adults with dementia, run through the Bird Conservancy of the Rockies, a local conservation group. Tyler Edmondson is an educator leading today's class. It's about feathers.
And so that's what we're going to focus on today. And we actually brought some really amazing feathers from real birds today for you to feel and look at.
Edmondson passes around the feathers and gives each resident a chance to participate.
And Chuck, it looks like we have your house finch down here on the ground with some really amazing red feathers.
Uh-huh.
What colors do you see on your bird?
A bird.
It's a pretty great bird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a real flat.
Not everyone is alert, but Edmondson speaks directly, even to residents that seem asleep. He touches feathers to their skin and gives them birds to hold.
We want to make sure they have a chance to have a response, even if we can't discern it or see it.
North Glen Heights Activities Director Gabriela DeMont-Santos says she was a little skeptical of the program at first.
When I came in, I had no idea what to expect of it.
But then she saw how it calmed residents and improved their moods. Take Chuck, who earlier called his bird flat. He's typically irritable and difficult to work with. DeMont-Santos says there are just two things that calm him down.
Yeah, Krispy Kreme and bird tails would brighten up his day anytime, that's for sure.
She believes one reason for the program's success is it works on many levels.
What's really nice about bird tails is it captures many different senses. You have visual, you have the physical touch, you hear the sound of the birds.
Bird tails was developed in 2011 by Audubon Society educator Ken Elkins and memory care specialist Randy Griffin. It's not completely clear why dementia patients respond to it so well, but its connection to nature may be one reason.
So there's not a ton of research about nature-based programs and people with dementia. It's something we're just now starting to look at.
Jennifer Dybert is a gerontologist who analyzed bird tails as part of her master's research at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. She says even though scientists haven't looked specifically at the dementia connection, psychologists and epidemiologists have shown exposure to nature has health benefits.
It really reduces stress, improves your mood, reduces depression, anger, anxiety. It enhances your feelings of pleasure.
As the Bird Tales program comes to an end, Tyler Edmondson asked the residents to use their birds one last time.
What we'd love for you to do is have them sing together, see if we can create a chorus.
Then he says it's time to return the birds to their nest. Not everyone wants to give theirs up, but Edmondson tells them it's okay. He and his birds will be back in a couple weeks. For The Pulse, I'm Stephanie Page Ogburn.
What if we could drastically diminish people's odds of getting Alzheimer's or dementia in the first place by editing their genes? It's one of the many potential promises of this approach, and the world's leading gene editing scientists met in Washington, D.C. this week to discuss the latest discoveries as well as the challenges facing them. We've heard a lot lately about a specific gene editing technique known as CRISPR. That stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats, if you want to know. And CRISPR has really pushed this field forward. It makes it possible to alter specific genes and to make the changes heritable, which could be used to cure or even eradicate many devastating genetic diseases. Jeff Axt is senior editor at The Scientist, and she was at this summit in Washington, so I asked her to sum up the good, the bad, and the potentially ugly aspects of gene editing.
So there's a lot of promise, and at the most basic level, we can use this technology to just edit genes, which is something that we've been doing for a long time, just not as efficiently. And so there are, we can treat diseases. There are dozens of gene therapies that are in clinical trials that are nearing their way to approval, and they can, you can knock out the receptor for HIV to help, cure HIV and make so they can't infect T cells. We can edit genes that are mutated to cause disease. But this is not really where the concerns are. So one of the big concerns is with editing the genomes of human embryos. And back in April, a Chinese group did this. The NIH then said they wouldn't fund this type of research, and it started all these discussions about when and how should we use this technology. So it's the germline editing. That's really where the concern is.
What does that mean? Describe that and what the problems are.
So the issue there is whether you're editing an embryo or a gamete that's going to make an embryo to bring about a genetically engineered human. When you're genetically modifying the egg or the sperm or the embryo, you're genetically modifying the whole human, as opposed to just going in and tweaking some of the cells of the liver that are carrying a mutant gene that's causing disease to fix liver disease or whatever it may be. It's the germline editing where you're going to give birth to an entire human that carries this genetic change that you've induced. So the obvious knee-jerk reaction is designer babies. You know, if we're editing the genomes of human embryos, we can just make whatever babies we want. Let's give them blonde hair, blue eyes, intelligent, long life, strong muscles, all of those things, this genetic enhancement. And there are obvious concerns there. Several speakers referenced Aldous Huxley's Brave New World in terms of government totalitarian control. There was a whole talk on eugenics. So these are like the big fears, the fear-mongering issues. But there are even human germline editing, the one that is causing all these fears, there are real applications for that as well. So, for example, when it comes to IVF screening and you want to screen to make sure a disease is not passed from parent to child, for example, that's a real use of this technology. We can go in and just change the embryo so it doesn't have those bad genes. And this is years and decades into the future. We have a lot to learn about this technology, but there are real ways we could do it in what I think most people would agree is ethical and worthwhile.
In terms of gene editing, how much of this is already happening and in use, and how much of this is future talk?
This is pretty much all future talk. So the closest we're at to using precision gene editing technologies in medicine today would be those gene therapies I mentioned. These are currently going through clinical trials, but they've used other types of technologies to edit their genes. Most of the stuff that we've talked about just now is far into the future. There's so much that we don't know about this technology. There's really a lot of basic research that still needs to be done.
So near future means what, 5 years, 10 years?
I guess that would probably be a good guess. So the gene therapies are still in clinical trials. It's probably going to be another few to 5 years before we even see any gene therapies approved at all. And once those are approved, you know, researchers are going to start incorporating the precision gene editing technologies to make those therapies more efficient and effective. So yeah, maybe 10 years at the nearest to see some CRISPR application in medicine. And that's, again, not touching on germline human editing, which would be years and years into the future.
Gene therapies got off to a rough start with trials that went terribly wrong, and then it came kind of to a complete halt. How does that history play into the excitement that we have right now?
That's a really interesting point. Certainly there were a lot of deaths and a lot of cancer cases that seemed to stem from the gene therapies. And one of the problems there was off-target effects, essentially, when you're causing a disruption in some other gene that then causes cancer. And that's absolutely one of the things that researchers are looking to improve upon with CRISPR and other precision gene editing technologies. And even, you know, now that those are more precise, they're still looking to improve upon those even more. So certainly there are lessons to be learned from the gene therapy field in terms of off-target effects and patient safety.
Jeff Axt is a senior editor at The Scientist, and she went to the Gene Editing Summit in Washington, D.C. this week. Listening to The Pulse, I'm Mike and Scott. Last year in December, Linda Jarrah of Philadelphia went to the doctor for a sinus infection. She took an antibiotic, but she didn't feel better. Weeks went by, she felt exhausted and terrible, and after many more doctor's visits and tests, it turned out her heart was failing. She's 43 years old. In the following months, she was in and out of the hospital 4 times, and doctors are still not sure what caused her heart health to deteriorate. She told us her story for our series, Patient Files.
They knew that they had to go to the next step, that I was not getting any better. So March 3rd, my mother's birthday, I had the LVAD put in. And what this device does is I have a pump that's right above my rib cage. And it has two, look like hoses that go in, and it's used to bypass the aorta. And it's a continuous flow that will keep my heart pumping. So I can't have a heart attack if that was to happen. I don't have a pulse. I can tell you where you can microphone it. That's me. That's what I sound like on the inside. So there's a guy at work who likes to make a joke about how anyone could come in his room as long as they have a pulse. And I was like, well, I'll just wait outside. So I could not come home because I live by myself. So I spent 3 months at my sister's house, sleeping in my niece's room. And she has like Taylor Swift posters up and everything's pink and princesses. And so she's 8 now and my nephew's 7. And there's always a story I tell about my nephew and my recovery. And I started with like walking 2 rooms down from mine in the hospital. And when I got to my sister's, I would do the hallway. That's about as much as I could do when physical therapy started. And I remember it was right before Easter and I had gone outside and I put some stuff in the mailbox and I walked up and down my sister's driveway and I did it for 7 minutes. And I was so excited and I came in and Brendan, my nephew, was the first person I saw. And I was like, Brendan, guess what? And he's like, what? He's excited for me. And I said, I just walked for 7 minutes straight. And his smile like turned into like disgust. And he was like, are you kidding me? That is like kindergarten easy. And you're excited about that? And I was just laughing because I wasn't laughing then. I kind of shuffled back to the bedroom and like put my head down. I was like, oh, I guess it was kindergarten easy. And I tell that story because I now do the elliptical. And the longest time I've spent on the elliptical is 7 miles. So I do the elliptical every day between 3 and 5 miles a day. And I'm really trying to get active. I went back to work full time. I teach 11th grade at Valley Forge Military Academy. I went to one of the support groups at Temple. And there were 4 of us there. It was myself, 76-year-old man, 78-year-old woman, and an 84-year-old woman. There are people on VADS who are so unhappy that they have this device. And obviously, I can't go in water. I can get electrocuted. And they just go on and they'll just complain about how they can't go swimming and they can't. But I'm like, but you're alive. And it was looking pretty bad for me. You know, I was glad to be alive. And there have been people who are considering VADS or people who just ask me, they're like, what made you decide to get this? And I was like, I didn't have a choice. I just remember, you know, at that time, my niece was 7. She's the oldest. And I just said, you know what? I want to go to her wedding. I want to dance at her wedding. There are 200,000 people that need hearts a year and about 2,000 become available. Hearts are good on average for about 10 years. Lungs are good for about 5 to 7 years. And I said, well, what does that mean? What do you mean? Like 10 years? They're like, well, in 10 years, then you just get listed again for, I'm like, I have to go through this again. And I was like, wait a minute. I don't even know if I want to do this now. And I was like, what are my chances? I did say, what are my odds if I just leave the hospital? I don't think my odds were very good. I don't think I had odds, to be honest with you. When I was first recovering and getting more out of the house at my sister's, people would say, oh, I could never do what you did. And I could never go through this. And I would say, you would, because when you're faced with these decisions, like you have to do it.
Linda is having some tests done to see if her heart is strong enough to live without the LVAD. If not, she'll continue waiting for a heart transplant. Our associate producer, Paige Flager, produced this piece. And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Tanine Dariush is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.